time has come for widespread recognition of the radical changes in religious beliefs throughout the modern world. The time is past for mere revision of traditional attitudes. There is great danger of final, and we believe fatal, identification of the word religion with doctrines and methods which have lost their significance and which are powerless to solve the problem of human living in the 20th century. Religions have always been means for realizing the highest values of life. Today, man's larger understanding of the universe, his scientific achievements, and deeper appreciation of brotherhood have created a situation which requires a new statement of the means and purposes of religion. Such a vital, fearless, and frank religion capable of furnishing adequate social goals and personal satisfactions may appear to many people as a complete break with the past. While this age does owe a vast debt to the traditional religions, it is nonetheless obvious that any religion that can hope to be a synthesizing and dynamic force for today must be shaped for the needs of this age. To establish such a religion is a major necessity of the present. It is a responsibility which rests upon this generation.
Those words were written and then published in 1933. The Humanist Manifesto was signed by 34 men, professors, philosophers, including John Dewey, Unitarian ministers, ethical culture leaders, one rabbi, and one lawyer. Together, those 34 wrote 15 theses. They meant it to be daring, courageous, a clear cry for a modern faith. They hoped to set minds free and, like Luther, reform the religious landscape of their times, establishing a new church, one built on science and reason. That's not quite what happened. I mean, although the American Humanist Association still exists, and through its website and chapter meetings and media campaigns, works to make a case for secular humanism, our culture is still in the middle of a debate, one that is settled into fairly familiar terms, often based in ethics, often aiming at the God, no God divide, and in some places it is writ very large and provokes a high-toned response. The religious humanists never grew into a modern religion, a new church. And in part, that's because they found such a congenial home in an old one, the Unitarian Church. You see, many of those 34 were already in Unitarian pulpits. The message was already going out Sunday mornings. And when those new groups emerged, meeting space was pretty easy to get for free. Oh, the secular humanists did break off and did establish their own institutions with budgets and committees and bylaws because they found the Unitarians to be, well, too churchy. But those humanists changed us forever. By the 1950s, we were no longer the most liberal Christian faith. The faith we had been since the time of Channing and Emerson and Thoreau. We were something else, no easier to define then than it is now. But read that manifesto of 1933, and underneath it, Underneath that academic and occasionally pedantic prose, you can feel the hunger. You can feel a passionate hope. You can hear what they were struggling for and get a sense of what they had to struggle against. Those 34 wanted a faith based not only in reason, but in science. A faith not held back by the past. In fact, they were very much like you and like me.
First, religious humanists regard the universe as self-existing and not created. Second, man is a part of nature. He has emerged as a result of a continuous process. Third, holding an organic view of life, humanists find that the traditional dualism of mind and body must be rejected.
They were careful thinkers, nimble around all the nuances of philosophy, but they were also a bit arrogant.
Fifth, humanism asserts that the nature of the universe depicted by modern science makes unacceptable any supernatural or cosmic guarantees of human values. Sixth, we are convinced that the time has passed for theism, deism, modernism, and the several varieties of new thought.
Even with so many men of faith involved in the writing, it is surprising that they managed to create a document so deaf to the rhythms of the imagination and insensitive to the heart's need for poetry.
Ninth, in the place of the old attitudes involved in worship and prayer, the humanist finds his religious emotions expressed in a heightened sense of personal life and in a cooperative effort to promote social well-being. Tenth, it follows that there will be no uniquely religious emotions and attitudes of the kind hitherto associated with belief in the supernatural.
And although they did say nothing human is alien to the religious, the ascetic and the ecstatic were not really warmly welcomed. The creativity they championed seemed to be pragmatic and purposeful. My mic is off. Okay. The creativity they championed seemed pragmatic and purposeful. And maybe this point is connected. Throughout the manifesto, they were oddly, embarrassingly gender-bound.
11th, man will learn to face the crises of life in terms of his knowledge of their naturalness and probability. Reasonable and manly attitudes will be fostered by education and supported by custom. We assume that humanism will take the path of social and mental hygiene and discourage sentimental and unreal hopes and wishful thinking.
Okay. There's a great deal of light for the mind here, but not enough warmth for the heart. And by 1939, they were talking about revising or even rewriting the whole thing. But the committee never met. From the letters that remain between some of those early signers, it's clear that some thought the manifesto was just fine the way it was. Others thought it was a good historical document. And some distanced themselves because there seemed to be no room for a sense of the tragic of life and no way to find words for the need for humility. 80 years later, their blind spots are so clear you can giggle. Many of you, if I had made you read the whole darn thing, would quickly file it away in that cabinet called history at the back of the closet. Something that was relevant only to scholars and those who have that odd hobby of studying the past. Although if any of you are here, I do have copies of the full manifesto in the back. I'm not kidding. It's worth reading. It's worth reading because we are still much like them. Oh, I know it has calmed down significantly, but that theist-humanist debate is not only on billboards in the Midwest. It lives here among us. We too feel the tension of our diverse theological stripes. And I know there are times when each of us, atheists or theists, liberal Christians or pagans, ethical souls or meditating agnostics, feel this diversity not as a sustaining richness, but as a chilly, maybe even scary recognition that we might be out here on the edge all by ourselves. We discover that others really do think very, very, very differently than we do. And maybe getting along here is going to mean soft peddling and hiding where our hearts really are. Now, when I first came to Boca, back when the dinosaurs still roamed, it was most often the theists who sounded almost apologetic when the conversations turned deep. Lately, it seems as if it's the atheists who are adopting that more tentative tone. When it happens, no matter what theological flavor, the faces get the very same worried look. As if maybe this place isn't the home I thought it might be. Maybe this place isn't as inclusive as it claims. Maybe there is no way we can stand together with this difference in thought. So here's this giving. Every one of us in our spiritual and ethical paths will in this place feel both tucked in, close and connected to a group of brilliantly delightful, like-minded folks, and sometimes even on the same day, unnerved because we see ourselves at the margin, afraid of being pushed out, or worse yet, just ignored. This is part of being a vibrant community. No doubt, our diversity is cumbersome and can be hard to work. And our search for common ground sometimes is marred by blind spots of our own. Don't believe me on that one, just sign up to preach a summer service. You'll find out it's more work and more fun than you ever imagined. But how do we find connection in spite of our differences? I think, in part, we do that by remembering who we are and why we're here. You see, when the question comes up, why can't we, the small we, this congregation, or the great big we you use all over the place, why can't we just get over that humanist-theist debate? Why can't we just decide who we are and move on to the important work that needs to be done? Because there is work that needs to be done. There is so much saving to do. So much work to heal ourselves and our planet, to help our neighbors, to bend society towards justice, to make beauty, to create peace. Why can't we just get on with it? Well, I think the answer is we are. You see, over the years, I think all of us have become religious humanists, no matter what other flavor spices our own personal theological stew. You see, all of us want a vital, a fearless, a frank religion, a faith that can be synthesizing, a dynamic force for today, a faith shaped by the needs of this age, by the longings of our hearts and our hopes for our children's future. Maybe what makes it so hard is that we have all accepted this as the responsibility which rests on our generation, too. And I think just like those 34 men, we are all trying to give shape and form to a power we feel and trust and know. And we've only got the old words to do it. What future hope can those old words mean? What can they usher into our children's lives? Well, to find that out, we need each other. For only with each other will we be able to avoid dancing around in our own blind spots and sounding a little antiquated or foolish, like they did. Only with each other will we be able to not build unintentional barriers or hurt others with an arrogance we can't see. As Raymond Bragg wrote in the introduction to that manifesto, may we take these words to heart. It is a product of many minds and represents a developing point of view. So let all of us be both brave and humble, honest and bold, and kind to one another as we move this dance along, and find ways to speak even with old words, the deep joy and hope that is in each of our hearts.
So stand the theses of religious humanism. The quest for the good life is still the central task for humankind. Humanity is at last becoming aware that we are responsible for the realization of the world of our dreams, and that we have within ourselves power for its achievement. Let us set our intelligence and will to the task.
And when we do, there's nothing that's bigger than us.